The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is AARP. Annual sponsors include Northwest Nazarene University and the Idaho Humanities Council. The moderator for today's forum is Sue Rentz.
Good afternoon. I'd like to acknowledge our media sponsors for our radio audience, Boise State Public Radio, KBOI 670, the Idaho Statesman, and Peppershock Media. And our City Club forums are made possible by support from our forum series sponsors, Micron and Echelon Group. The Boise Police Department reports that 25% of all its emergency calls are mental health related. Today's forum on the intersection of policing and mental health brings together three experts who will enlighten us on positive steps that have been taken to deal with adults who have mental health challenges and come in contact with law enforcement. In 2014, groundwork was laid on two fronts to change the way mental health issues are handled when a 911 call is made or a person comes in contact with a police officer. First, after a small pilot project that was proposed by community paramedics, local agencies in Ada County began testing the use of a psychiatric evaluation team, or referred to as PET, to provide mental health screening and diversion, working with law enforcement, Department of Health and Welfare, Mobile Crisis Unit, and other partners. The second front was funding was approved by the Idaho Legislature for an initial community crisis center, a place for adults to go who are experiencing a mental health crisis. The first one opened in Idaho Falls in 2014, followed by centers in Twin Falls and Coeur d'Alene in the next 2 years. And in late 2017, the Pathways Community Crisis Center opened in Boise. Our panelists will address how their different agencies work in collaboration to help create more positive outcomes for adults who are experiencing a mental health crisis. And I'd just like to remind you that as our speakers speak, you're free to ask a question using one of the question cards on your tables and raise your hand. Someone will collect them, bring them to me so that we can have questions for the second part of our program today. I'm going to introduce our speakers in the order in which they'll speak. Ross Edmonds has a Master's of Social Work and more than 20 years of clinical and administrative experience in the mental health field. He's the administrator of the Division of Behavioral Health at the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare. He oversees outpatient mental health services and substance use disorder treatment in Idaho, as well as the operation of Idaho's two psychiatric hospitals in Orofino and Blackfoot for people who've been court-ordered into the state's custody. Chief William Bones is a veteran of 25 years as a Boise police officer. Appointed chief of police by Mayor Beter in 2015, February, he created the position of mental health coordinator during his first year as chief. He has also implemented crisis intervention teams within the department. He has a Bachelor of Science degree and is also a graduate of the FBI National Academy. And Dawn Ray has a Bachelor of Science also. She's been with Ada County Paramedics for 15 years and works as a community paramedic. In that role, she helped develop the psychiatric emergency team, which partners a community paramedic with a Department of Health and Welfare mobile crisis clinician. PET responds along with Ada County's law enforcement agencies to a variety of 911 calls involving citizens experiencing a mental health crisis. Dawn will give us her view from on the ground. And with that, I'll turn the program over to Ross.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. Sorry, I can't see you all sitting at that table. But I really appreciate it. In particular, I'd like to say thank you for the students for attending. Mental illness is one of those really challenging areas that often is stigmatized heavily. And I guess, you know, a few things I would say about that, just in sort of kicking this off, is I don't know how many of you know this, but people with serious mental illness die about 20 years earlier than people without serious mental illness. Every time I hear that or say that, it always sort of shocks me. Why is that? 20 years earlier. It's not related to suicide, necessarily. It's related to chronic health problems. Because a person with serious mental illness struggles just to get out of bed in the day sometimes. They struggle with the symptoms of their mental illness so much that they ignore those other chronic health conditions that they're dealing with. So just a few statistics really quick. Data, you see both of these things, but about 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 people at any given time suffers from a diagnosable mental illness. So look around the room. About 25% of us could likely be suffering from a diagnosable mental illness. Sometimes, the severity of that is always, of course, different. About 1 in 10 youth experience major depressive episode at some point in their childhood. 1 in 10, and about 5% of the general population have what we refer to as a serious mental illness. So, a serious mental illness typically is the more the more serious diagnoses like schizophrenia, schizoaffective, major depression, bipolar, some of the ones that you might all have heard of, and that it has a major impact on their life. It creates an inability for them to function successfully in some areas of their life. So one of the things in considering this topic is the concept, the intersection between policing and mental illness. One of the things that I think jumps up, and one of the reasons when we talked about doing this initially, was I think that there's a myth out there that people with mental illness are dangerous or violent. And that really couldn't be further from the truth. Now, what is accurate is that a person with mental illness that's untreated can be a bit spontaneous, can be a bit unpredictable, and sometimes that leads to sort of struggles in their lives. But only 3 to 5% of violent crime that you hear about in the news is related to somebody that has a serious mental illness. Only about 3 to 5%. I'd like to say that mental illness is not a life choice. It is a very highly stigmatized condition, and it is a disease just like any other disease, right? It is. It's just like asthma. It's just like diabetes. It's a chronic health condition that people suffer from. And the other thing that makes it very similar to other types of healthcare is that it is treatable, and treatment does work. So last couple of things that I would touch on before I turn it over to who at least I really want to hear from, and probably I hope you all do too, is a couple more things. I guess I would just encourage all of us, and maybe for the students in the room, I'm encouraging you even a little bit stronger, is to recognize that people that are suffering from mental illness, really they feel like tourists or strangers in their own communities. They don't feel a part of their own communities. Oftentimes they look scary, they seem scary, we cross the road because we don't want to walk by them. But I would just encourage you to recognize that this is just a medical condition. That's what this is. So don't be scared if you have classmates that seem different or strange. It's not. If you see them suffering from a different medical condition, they could also seem that way. So I just want to encourage that. Lastly is just to really express, I want to touch on a couple of recent advances in our system. And really, our governor and our legislature deserve so much credit. The last 5 years in terms of investment in the behavioral health system is unprecedented in Idaho. We've invested a ton of resources in behavioral health. When I say behavioral health, I'm usually talking about the combination of mental illness and substance use disorders, so we'd call it behavioral health. But we touched on the crisis centers. last legislative session, two legislative sessions ago, the Idaho legislature appropriated over $5 million for the treatment of individuals that are on felony probation and parole, because we recognize the needs of that population. We're looking at bed expansion in our state psychiatric hospitals that the legislature has funded. There's many examples. The crisis centers is one of the best examples of that. So I just want to say thank you again for having us here. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak with you about this. I look forward to any of the questions that you have. And with that, I'll take the opportunity to pass it off to the chief.
Well, first, thanks for everybody that's here in the room, and thanks to everybody that's out there in the listening audience and the radio, not just for being here, tuning in, but for taking an interest in something that is so key to our society, and hopefully you're here to help take those next steps, to help move that needle. First modern police officer walked out into the streets of London in 1829, and from that moment forward, the interactions between police officers and those suffering from mental health issues have been a component of every officer's duty shift. Unfortunately, it's taken law enforcement and society almost another 200 years to begin to understand the impact of mental health in our world. Even now, while the science of understanding mental health has moved forward dramatically, that veil of stigma attached to mental illness remains largely in place across our country. As Ross said, although science has long ago demonstrated that mental illness is a medical condition, for many it still conveys embarrassment, a lack of understanding, and even fear. While the underlying cause might be body chemistry imbalance, a physical injury, or psychological trauma, for most, mental health continues to be perceived very differently from all other medical conditions. Many people's view of somebody with mental illness versus other medical conditions like high blood pressure, broken leg, or that diabetes begin with the very mention of the words mental illness. It changes. It clicks in some people's minds. Such a negative connotation. The differentiation of perception by society when it comes to mental illness has driven many of the reasons for the growing role of police in helping those with mental health challenges. Avoiding acknowledging oneself or family members are suffering from mental illness means a lack of treatment. And for the more serious cases, for the most serious cases of untreated mental illness, a strong likelihood occurs for future interaction with the police. The majority of mental health incidents officers have handled over these last 200 years primarily have focused on the problem of the moment. The, quote, solution largely involved either putting a Band-Aid on the situation and walking away, taking a person on a mental hold and placing them under an involuntary psychiatric hold, or using one of the only other tools officers possessed, criminal enforcement. Very little training was given to officers in understanding the role of mental health issues which play in their interactions, nor in how to more effectively provide help to those in crisis. Officers, as was society, were more likely to focus strictly on the actions the person had taken rather than on any underlying mental health nexus which had led to those actions. It's essential to understand that being mentally ill is no more a crime than having that high blood pressure. This said, mental illness is not a pass for criminal activity. The challenge for police officers is to look at the intent and causal factors behind the action, not just the underlying action itself. In Boise, as was stated, 25% of the calls that we're dispatched to have a nexus to mental health issues. 10,000 calls per year have a direct tie to mental illness, and another 15,000 have an indirect but contributing causality. The call for service might be a simple welfare check, maybe for a care center walk away. Could be strange statements made by a homeless man on the side of the street. It could be your neighbor's house, for anything from a child who's out of control to a suicidal father. That phone call asking for help comes at a moment of crisis, when an individual, family, business, or school has lost the ability to cope with the strain of the moment. For a responding officer, it might be a case of just simply providing a calming presence, starting a conversation around resources, helping to point someone in the right direction. In the most extreme cases, it can mean responding to violent physical confrontation or even a life lost to suicide. A common call, one of the more common calls we get the first time to respond to a situation, is when a person's behavior is degraded due to a failure to take prescribed medications. If it's the first time we've responded with that family, the questions are almost always the same. Why can't you force the pills down them? Why can't you take them on a mental hold, take them away? The answers to both is the same. We all possess the same constitutional rights. When an officer places someone on a mental hold, they're taking their physical liberties away. And while not an arrest, it deprives them of their freedom. Our Constitution, laws, and officers all take this very seriously. Officers are only empowered to place someone on a mental hold without a court order when the person is in imminent danger to themselves or others, or they are gravely disabled. As to medication, I think everybody listening would agree, those same constitutional protections prevent an officer from forcing you to take medications you don't want to take. But aside from the legal constraints, it's the duty of a police officer to do the right thing. That transcends across all emergency services. Not to take enforcement action or someone's liberty because the law allows it, but to make decisions which reflect the ethics and philosophy of our departments and communities. We do place people under mental holds, but where it's necessary to protect themselves or others from an immediate danger, where it is an assistance. In reality, police officers, as other first responders, are afforded few actual tools to take definitive action with somebody suffering from significant mental illness. Officers aren't licensed to practice law or psychology. However, to do effectively what we ask them to do, they have to be experts in both. The number one ability that officers possess is their communication skills. And while that's always been a part of what an officer has done in the past, the fastest growing role is that of a counselor. Working with individuals and families to help solve problems which have not been traditionally perceived as a police officer's responsibility nor the government's responsibility. To provide help to someone suffering from mental illness, officers have to look outside those traditional response models. They have to look to their community, understand the system for providing mental health services as a whole, to find how police can most effectively connect people to those resources. Policing has to step past solving the problem of the moment and become an intake point in a continuum of care as part of a holistic community response to providing those resources. How police respond to the challenges of mental health has begun to undergo significant change in the last decade. Academy curriculums have begun to include specific training, not simply on the existence of mental health issues, but on growing officers' skills to de-escalate stress incidents involving mental illness. For the past decade, Boise has made CIT, or our Crisis Intervention Team training, a core part of the regimen for training for both new and current officers. Police officers are given an understanding of the various types of mental illness, and more importantly, how to respond to those suffering from the related symptoms. 15 years ago, there would have only been a handful of law enforcement leaders across the country that knew what CIT meant. 10 years ago, it was a brand new concept that agencies were looking at. Today, the majority of large agencies across the nation have integrated it into their curriculums. Understanding is just a first step, though. Each of those instances where a police officer contacts a person suffering from mental illness can provide an opportunity, a chance to interact with somebody upstream before they hit those rapids or that waterfall where crisis can strike. And for the Boise Police Department, this means not just improving the training for the officers, but creating a bridge to the resources in our community that they're in need of. 3 years ago, BPD created a full-time mental health coordinator position. We went into the community to recruit and hire an expert in mental health services and bring those skills and connections to the department. For that person, it's Penelope Hansen, who happens to be sitting in the audience. Officers who find someone in need of service are able to coordinate with Penelope and connect service providers to the person in need. The position has also allowed the department to identify those highest users of service and those most at risk to allow for proactive contacts rather than the reactive model we've been stuck in. In doing so, future calls for service are prevented, strain on resources is reduced, and most importantly, those people get help. The model requires time and effort. This isn't a position where all the work can be done for a desk. Penelope partners with officers to go into the field, locate those in need of service, and persuade them to accept our outstretched hands for offering help. And whether it's a gentleman that's papered his entire house in tinfoil and believes everybody is spying on him, or it's the young lady you read about in the news last week who is naked and with a knife and trying to run down the streets of Boise, it's finding help for those individuals. Police can assist someone in taking a step towards getting help, but we're still just one part, an entry point in a continuum of care. Across Boise, we've seen government and nonprofit businesses stepping up to fill the need. And as you said, my hat's, as you heard already, my hat is truly off to the governor and the legislature for stepping up on the crisis centers. Pathway Crisis Center here in Boise, which opened last year, is one of the greatest tools we have to provide an opportunity for help while reducing emergency room and jail visits. The crisis centers are having a significant impact on reducing the strain on emergency services across the state. In fact, the greatest numbers of each of the crisis centers across the state are self-admissions. Think about that for a moment. Every one of those self-admissions is a call that didn't come into police, firefighters, paramedics, that freed up emergency rooms resources. For those living on the edge of society and suffering from mental illness, obtaining help can be a really high mountain to climb. These are the people whom officers tend to see on repeated calls for service, sometimes even multiple times a day. Those who come to be on a first-name basis with firefighters, paramedic, and emergency room staff. And while relatively few in number, we see these individuals across the country who can rack up enormous costs and resources into the tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars for a single individual in a single year. Projects like New Path Housing Center, currently under construction here in Boise, create not just a place to live, but the wraparound services allowing for individual success in some of our most challenging cases. While not inexpensive, options like these types of services can provide significant long-term savings to taxpayers, while at the same time saving lives. Across the Treasure Valley, government, nonprofits, and private business have been creating new programs, looking at the best ideas across the country, bringing them back and incorporating them into models to serve our citizens. And while I leave it to my colleagues to go into detail, I can tell you programs like the Crisis Intervention Team Collaborative, the Assertive Community Treatment Team, and one of my favorites, the PET or Psychiatric Emergency Team, make an incredible difference. The future will continue to present new challenges. In addition to those we already face, America has an aging population, and almost all of our communities are facing a lack of secure memory care centers. Nationally, we are seeing increases in teen suicides tied to our millennial generation. Long-term military conflicts have taken an incredible toll on those who served, and many will not show the evidence done for many years. Each of these groups are people we should be seeking to help today, not just upstream, but if possible, before they can ever fall into that river. The lens through which we see the world's changing. Both law enforcement and society are beginning to understand the enormity of the role mental health has in our everyday lives. The stigma for which so long has attached to mental illness is starting to fade. These, however, are just first steps. We need to grow community understanding, continue to build a continuum of care, and be willing to take new and innovative approaches. To be successful, we must do more than solve the problems of today. We need to anticipate the challenges of tomorrow. For both today and tomorrow, I believe police are a key component to solving these issues, and the Boise Police Department is and will be continued to finding those solutions. And some of those solutions are sitting right next to me. Dawn?
I'd like to thank the City Club for hosting this forum and allowing us to highlight some of the work that continues in our community on a daily basis. So the topic today is the intersection of policing and mental health. Mr. Edmonds spoke about mental health. Chief Bones addressed some of the policing issues surrounding mental health. And I'm here to address the intersection. The intersection is where we as responders do our best to combine the two, at times, seemingly disparate issues. So I'll start at the very beginning, as I realize many don't understand the ins and outs of how emergency services work and who does what, focusing, of course, on mental health-related calls as the process is different for every incident type. A call is placed to the Ada County Dispatch Center, either through 911 or the non-emergency line. An individual may place the call themselves, or very often it is a concerned family member, friend, coworker, or neighbor. At times, it may be a crisis line or a mental health provider who has been in contact with an individual. Whoever the caller is, they have found themselves faced with a crisis that exceeds their resources, and they reach out to who they know will always respond, the police, the paramedics, and the fire department. Dispatchers, using their training and standardized questions, determine what resources are needed to respond. If there is no immediately identified medical need, for an example, an individual is overdosed or otherwise harmed themselves, the call becomes a law enforcement response only. Prior to the inception of PET, and certainly prior to the adoption of an expansion of CIT training, responding officers once on scene would interview the individual, as well as whomever placed the call, to determine whether the legal criteria for an involuntary hold had been met. If it was, the person was taken to an emergency department where they would be evaluated and wait for the next available inpatient psychiatric bed. If the criteria was not met, that was that. Law enforcement was given a single tool, the involuntary hold, for these types of calls. If it couldn't be used, there were no other options readily available to patrol officers and deputies. The integration of PET and widespread CIT training has expanded the availability of mental health resources and provided officers with a much more diverse set of tools, as Chief Bones referred to. With these changes, the response to incidents has improved for all of us involved. So I'll now explain PET, the psychiatric emergency team, a little bit further. As said in the introduction, it is an Ada County paramedic, community paramedic, partnered with the licensed clinicians from the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare's Mobile Crisis Unit, or MCU. I'll use MCU as an acronym a little bit, so Mobile Crisis Unit. We began responding to mental health calls within Ada County in September of 2014 after a brief pilot to validate a screening tool. The team was initially formed with the very narrow focus of just diverting from the emergency departments those individuals that had been placed on involuntary holds by law enforcement. As we evolved, it became apparent that our role could be much more than that. Currently, a call is placed at the dispatch center and resources assigned in much the same way as I previously described. During the hours of PET availability, which is Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to 10 p.m., the community paramedic on duty reads the law enforcement incident information and contacts the MCU clinician for any background information on the individual in crisis. For a small subset of our community, there is a voluntary registry that lives within MCU. These are individuals that may come into contact with law enforcement on a somewhat regular basis due to the severity of their mental illness. The registry allows them to voluntarily provide information that can be helpful during interactions while they are in crisis, how they may present to responders, who to call for assistance, and what works when they're sick. If the person is not in this registry but has had contact with MCU in the past, the clinicians can provide some background and history. This information is then communicated to the officers prior to the making contact, giving them a better situational awareness of the individual in crisis. Once the officers have arrived on scene and determined there is no safety risk, PET, who has been en route and in contact with the officers, joins the response. When expedient, we travel together in an Ada County paramedic SUV, as this allows us to remain in radio and MDT, or mobile data terminal, contact with the officers on scene. What happens there is from there is a collaborative decision based on all team members' area of expertise. If it is determined that the individual should be involuntarily hospitalized for their safety, the community paramedic can medically evaluate them for a direct admission to an inpatient psychiatric facility. The MCU clinician provides a detailed mental health assessment to the hospital staff. The officer places the person in protective custody and transports them safely to the facility, where a warm handoff takes place with all members of the team. This process places a person in crisis in a facility where they can begin receiving appropriate assistance immediately. Of course, this all depends on the availability of beds within our local psychiatric hospitals, which are very often at times at capacity. If this is the case and no bed is available, the individual is taken to the emergency department. However, now the emergency department social worker is given the same mental health assessment report from the MCU clinician to aid in treatment while awaiting that inpatient bed. I feel that some of our biggest successes are with those individuals that don't require that level of care. In collaboration with officers, we assist with voluntary admissions to the Pathways Crisis Center for stabilization and resource referrals. Or, when appropriate, PET returns officers to patrol service while we can coordinate referrals, resources, make appointments. We discuss safety plans with patients and their supports. After the crisis, PET also refers the individual to BPD's mental health coordinator or to MCU to check in the next day and assure the patient, the client, has stabilized and sought ongoing preventative care. These check-ins and supports can last for as long as necessary for that individual. PET will also reach out to an individual's mental health provider or medical provider, advise them of the crisis, what was done, what resources were referred to, and who to contact for more information. Our goal to provide people with resources is to avoid further crises and with alternatives to 911 if a crisis does in fact occur. We also frequently encounter calls that don't fall within this part of adult mental health crisis populations. PET also works closely with the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare's Children's Mental Health Department to provide resources and guidance to officers and parents when a minor is in crisis. As most everyone is aware, Alzheimer's and other dementias, as well as traumatic brain injuries, as Chief Bones referred to, are growing issues around the country, and Ada County is no exception. Work is being done across the state and across disciplines and agencies to begin addressing the difficulties these diagnoses can present for families and communities. The Idaho State Statute expressly excludes from the involuntary hold process those folks who have developmental disabilities, intellectual disabilities, or, as is stated in the code, aged, unless, of course, it is accompanied by a mental illness. Those caveats are in place for a variety of very valid reasons. However, in the midst of the crisis, it leads to creating problem solving by those responders on scene. PET, officers, deputies, and EMS work together to find the most appropriate and safe dispositions for these calls. More work is needed and continues on the issues behind these challenges and could probably warrant a forum or two themselves. That being said, in the past 4 years, PET has assisted law enforcement on nearly 1,200 calls for service, diverting from emergency rooms on 115 people that have been placed on an involuntary hold by Ada County law enforcement. As I said previously, though, some of our most rewarding and effective calls have been those individuals not involuntarily hospitalized. As with any form of preventative measure, we struggle sometimes to prove the efficacy of what we do from a data standpoint. However, anecdotally, the collaborative response has been met with enthusiasm from patients, families, providers, law enforcement, and EMS. Patients and families feel their illness is being addressed holistically, and responders are no longer left feeling that there are other options and further resources than what had been traditionally available. The collaboration that is conducted in Ada County on a daily basis is unique and not available in many areas, even in larger population centers. It ensures a safe response to mental health crises in our community and provides all responders with the tools to most effectively help our neighbors. This is evidenced by our support. The St. Louis Community Health Improvement Fund has provided grant money to expand the hours of PET to our current 12-hour shifts. The Ada County Indigent Services allocates a portion of their budget to offset some of the Ada County paramedics' expenses in staffing the response. And in 2017, the Region 4 Behavioral Health Board funded a two-day meeting facilitated by former Sheriff Gary Rainey, where the CIT Collaborative, as Chief Bones referenced earlier, determined our ongoing goals and missions. On behalf of PET, Ada County Paramedics, and our partners in public safety, thank you for this opportunity to showcase the advances that we have made. With the support of our community, we can continue to provide safe, effective, compassionate, and timely responses to crises of all sorts. It is truly all of our honor and privilege to do so 24 hours a day, 365 days a year.
Thank you to all our speakers, and I would remind our radio audience that you're listening to a City Club forum on the intersection of policing and mental health with speakers Ross Edmonds, Chief Bones, and Don Ray, a community paramedic. We have way more questions than we can get to, but they're all very thoughtful, and I thank you for them. First, does Ada County have adequate mental health and detox units, places to take people who are in crisis? And if not, what should we be doing about that?
Okay. No. That's good enough. We've come a long ways in developing the resources, particularly in Ada County. There's some great resources. Allenby House, which is a detox unit. Our crisis center opened a year ago. So there's been a lot of movement there. But as by way of example, one of the richest in terms of per capita funding for treatment in the country is in Vermont. It's one of the places that funds the highest. And when I visit with folks in Vermont, it is the exact same struggles that we have here. They have the same problems, the same challenges, the same need for additional resources. So I guess what I would say in terms of if we want to focus our attention on something, focus our attention on the recognition of a community, the best response to mental health challenges that people face is a community response. It's the collaboration that exists between the entity setting up here, it's the collaboration of the citizens. It's not allowing someone to feel like a stranger in their own community. So let's not do that. Let's really reach out and bring them in and then have the resources there to be able to do it. And we're growing those resources. So anything else to add?
No, I would also add that the Pathways Community Crisis Center has changed the way that we do business in the emergency services field. Before, our answer was always, well, I guess we'll just take them to the emergency room. This gives us a different option. Our emergency rooms are becoming more crowded as our population grows, and certainly somebody experiencing a mental health crisis, the ED is not the most appropriate place for them. So we've really appreciated having Pathways open.
I guess the one other thing I would add is we have a bottleneck. The folks that Chief Bones and Don were speaking about that are being placed on mental holds, oftentimes those folks get committed to the state. Our state hospital beds are always full. Always full. We never have vacancies at the state hospital. What happens is they then have to stay in community psychiatric hospitals waiting for a bed at the state hospital. Those are also always full in the state of Idaho. There's very little space in our community psychiatric hospitals, which means people have to stay in emergency departments even longer. So at each stop along that create those bottlenecks, we need additional resources. We need better resources in the community to move people out of those facilities. We are working on it. We're going to be expanding our state hospital beds by 20 in the next couple of years. So doing everything we can to try to get that bottleneck moving.
Great. I have a question related to the role of Ada County. Someone says that the Ada County Commissioners have not taken a seat on the Pathways Crisis Center Board. What do you think the role of the county should be?
Do you want to take that one around? So that's a little above my pay grade.
I guess I'll take it
so that I can avoid the political outflow from the two people that are working for a county. It's everybody's struggle. Now, the county stepped up. They're a partner in Allenbaugh House, which has been a major, major lift. And so everybody's resources are short. And obviously, you know, from the policing side, we need more resources, we need more resources. But I understand there's a limited, and all those resources are coming from the same pot, right? It's the taxpayer. It's the individuals that are listening to this out there. So we have to balance the response. I don't blame anybody for any lack of participation, because at a county level, and when I say county level, I'm talking about what I'm seeing from the state contributing to the crisis centers, the local law enforcement, putting together the psychiatric collaborative team. Everybody is trying to come to the table to find a solution. There are community after community after community across this country where nobody is working together. And it's much more important to see the collaboration of approach, of building that continuum of care where everybody is working together. And the more we're able to do on the front end, and I cannot overemphasize the PET team, those are all people that aren't going into the system. If I was to look at one place where we're really dropping down, we're talking about the most serious cases. We can stop so many of these from ever getting to this point as a community, as a society. If we can bring people to where mental illness doesn't have this negative stigma, where people are able to seek the help and get that assistance on the front end before they get to this point. We're struggling because people get into crisis, and there's always going to be those people, but we can make an intersection that takes them out of the stream, far, far reduce the number of resources we have to spend on this end. So, no, I think the county has stepped up in numerous ways. Yeah, I work for the city, so if some other agency can contribute to that budget, that's always great. But everybody really is coming to the table right now.
This question has to do with coordination. Is there a coordination between Treasure Valley police departments and emergency responders in Eagle, Meridian, and Star in regard to mental health?
I can talk about that if you want to.
No, I turn that over to Dawn. Just, I'm sure she wants to talk about CITC and PET.
Yeah, so this is, we've just recently in the last 2 years have started what we call the CITC, the Crisis Intervention Training Collaborative. It's the group of all law enforcement agencies across Ada County, Mobile Crisis, the Ada County Paramedics, the Department of Health and Welfare's Children's Mental Health. We have Area Agency on Aging. We have the VA. We all come together every 2 weeks and discuss the previous 2 weeks' mental health calls, who was placed on a hold, unfortunately, who may have completed suicide in our community, and discuss what can we do to make sure that these folks are receiving the proper resources. It is absolutely unique. We've been contacted by multiple agencies across the country about what we do, but it really does show everyone in this valley's commitment to working together. And we continue to move forward in what our goals and missions are, as I talked about earlier.
You know, working in collaboration, it's sharing information first, right? And so all the law enforcement agencies across the valley now all share the same information systems. It's working together. You know, we've got Penelope, who teams with officers. Ada County's got two teams of two officers that go out and proactively do the same thing. We all try to learn from each other the best steps, but the number one progress that we've made is being able to build a continuity of approach for somebody on the front end. Because as we talked so long ago, an officer had no options. Now they've got the ability to pick up the phone, and the PET team's monitoring the same dispatch calls the officers are going to. Mm-hmm. They're picking up those calls often before we can get there. It doesn't have to be a police officer that calls Penelope. If we run into somebody that lives in the county, I don't have to say, well, it's the county's problem. I can reach out to those officers that are doing the same outreach or the PET team, and we can work as a collective to try to get that person into services. It's not about geographical borders drawn on some map because it's a city, county, or state. It's about the citizens that we serve, and we all serve every member, whether they're a person that lives here, whether they're a person that's passing through. We're here to get them help, and it's in our best benefit to work together to do that.
Great. Can you describe how mental health issues affect child protection scenarios? What type of support is provided to the children, parents, or others involved? It's probably one for you, Ross.
Yeah, thank you. You know, we could talk about that. Certainly we see a high prevalence of mental illness amongst the families that get involved with the child protection system. I think probably more so it's substance use disorder problems that we see in terms of the families involved in child protection. Until you walk a mile in my shoes, it's really difficult to judge families. We see some really awful incidents of child abuse, but we, you know, most of the calls that child protection deals with isn't a physical or a sexual abuse. It's neglect most often, and that neglect is very difficult to deal with. And often those families, those parents, and caregivers are suffering from their own mental illness. So we do see a fair amount of it. We have specific line items in our budget, specific programming that we do specific for families, access to services specific to families involved in child protection. We want to see families stay connected. We don't want to take kids and place them unless absolutely necessary into a foster care system. We want kids to stay at home, but we want their families to have the resources they need to be able to effectively raise their kids.
Great, thank you. And this is one probably more directed to the chief, and it's kind of two-pronged. How can we institute a focus on rehabilitative services for mentally ill people who've been convicted and are in the criminal justice system already? And then the second part of it was, what special training do officers receive or support for their own mental health needs?
Really two different issues and both
right. Huge.
So obviously a large percentage of our incarcerated population suffers from mental illness, a much higher population than we see in the general population. And unfortunately, we know that some of that was tied to lack of services. As we said earlier, that's not a pass on criminal activity, but you've got to look underneath. The state has struggled on funding. It's been one of those areas. It's very expensive to get resources on the front end. One of the biggest moves, I've got to tell you, I'm so happy, is the $5 million that was allocated by the legislature a couple years ago, and I'm hoping to see that move towards the medication side. So we've been struggling, and part of that's targeted at meeting this gap. people get stabilized in prison. Maybe they didn't have those medications, didn't have access. They get on the medications. Everything is stable. Then when they exit the prison, so often there's this gap between the time they leave and the 2 weeks of medication they're given and that ability to get more medication. And that's a dangerous time, right? That's where we lose so much. So we might have all this rehabilitation and training that's taking place, got somebody stabilized, and all of a sudden they're without the medication, resources, ability to get that, maybe without the backside supportive resources. So getting a system on the back end on the release is really one of the areas that we're seeing increased focus on. It's expensive. It takes a lot of resources, but we're actually seeing a significant movement. I'm very hopeful to see us move in that direction and take that gap and eliminate it on the medication side. That's going to be one of our biggest wins for police officers. So I'm much more likely to lose an officer to suicide than I am to an officer-involved shooting. That's true across this country. I am deeply thankful that we have yet to do that here in Boise, but we're one of the few large departments that hasn't seen that and seen that multiple times. There's never a week goes by that I'm not reading a story about an officer lost to mental illness. It's a high-stress profession. It takes a deep toll on officers, and we're one of those professions where I can't show any weakness. And that same stigma that's out there in society, even though we deal with it every day, think of the stigma inside of admitting to mental illness. We are pushing that in a very, very big way internally. We have a peer support team that reaches out, and it's officer reaching out to officer. We just finished the Below 100, but teaching our officers about stress, stress relief, focusing on family and getting out. Obviously, we're very lucky. We have great health care benefits and the ability to seek out care and help when we need it, but getting somebody to stretch out that arm can be the same as getting somebody on the street. So we're highly conscious in law enforcement. There's multiple programs across the country. I'm on one of the boards trying to get resources to officers, particularly in the smaller departments, where this does carry less resources and a greater stigma than some of the larger departments where they've seen people go through it and seen people come out the other side. When you've seen those success stories, it's easier to say, I can follow that. But when we keep this veil in place around mental health, people don't see those success stories. They so often happen behind closed doors, and we only hear about the worst. So it's deep in my mind. It's deep in the mind of every law enforcement leader and every officer I know across the country right now.
Thank you. And Don, I think this one would be more for your answer. Is there a plan or talk of trying to implement and have PET teams in other parts of the state since they've been kind of piloted here?
And Ross can probably address this somewhat. The Department of Health and Welfare has recognized the success that we've had with PET and with CIT and have recently assigned someone to look at what we do and then look at how that can apply to other other areas of the state. I think what we do here in Ada County is good for Ada County. I think what we do here in Ada County can be applied to smaller areas, especially those that are so resource poor. I don't know how many of you folks are aware of this, but in most of Idaho, their emergency response systems or EMS systems are volunteers, and they're volunteer EMT basics that don't receive the level of training that I did. But I do believe that they have an impact, and they can have an impact working alongside their law enforcement agencies. You get in some of those smaller counties, and it's a one-officer response, and they're probably really reliant upon their EMS systems to help them. I think that the what we do, the program that we've gone forward with, the training that we're able to move with, I think is certainly applicable to the rural areas. And with CIT as well, that communication that happens between disciplines is huge, especially if you're looking at having a smaller pool of resources.
The only thing I would say is I don't know how many of you live in Ada County or in Boise, but we're very lucky because of these two. We're very lucky because of the collaboration. Police chiefs, and I'll include sheriffs, they don't all have the same approach to this as our fantastic chief. So thank you for what you do. So we're constantly looking at ways to apply this sort of a thing areas across the state. It's very difficult. You have to have somebody like our chief here in Boise that's willing to do this. It's willing to look at this and apply resources. Sorry, there's a fly. Really, really very dedicated to my forehead right now. So we have to have, you know, it's a connection. CIT, crisis intervention training teams that we've been talking about, that doesn't start with health and welfare. That doesn't start with treatment providers. That starts with law enforcement. Law enforcement has to be the ones that really drives that. And we're seeing it all across the state. It's growing very advanced here in Ada County and with Boise Police Department.
Great. Now, this one might be more in the chief's bailiwick. In recent years, especially when there's another school shooting, people bring up the topic of mental health. And what's your advice for correctly navigating the relationship between mental illness and gun violence?
Well, first I'm going to start, see something, say something. If something seems out of place, if you hear something, something seems wrong with a child or an individual, anybody you know, say something. Let us get into that. Whenever we have a school shooting, I cringe because I know if it's a big national story, I'm going to see the outfall of that across the country and locally. So we knew it was going to happen this year. We've had several threats related to school shootings just locally here in our own valley. But what we've been able to do in most of those, because so many of those involve a child, right? They involve somebody that's making a threat against classmates, is we've been able to connect resources using that CITC model, working with the schools and the service providers. And sometimes we've got a serious problem. Sometimes we've got somebody just blowing off steam or making threat. But to do an evaluation and get those kids, or if it's an adult, either into medical, psychological services, or if we've got a criminal action, to be able to take a criminal action. But in any case, it gives us an opportunity to intercept before crisis might strike. And we have to treat each of those seriously. There's no dropping the ball on a threat against a school safety. But without that communication, this wouldn't be happening. I've got to tell you, even 15 years ago, the concept of a school sharing that kind of information, or some of the protected medical, you know, walking the line on HIPAA, are we too scared? Can we talk to each other? Can we talk to the law enforcement? Law enforcement, well, we can't share our information. Those barriers are gone. What we can legally share, we're sharing, and that's driving a response to the individuals that's letting us make that change before the violence happens. I can't protect against the negativity happening. We were talking this afternoon or this morning about a gentleman that we've got that's got severe psychological problems, and every time we go out, it's a deep breath of if something's going to happen, because he's pulled the fake, you know, the BB gun on officers. He's had the sword in his hand, and you're just... Officers are on this struggle of, I've got to try to de-escalate this, use these verbal skills, but I got to protect myself and others too. And we try to employ distance and time, and every single one of these calls is a multiple officer call to make it more safe for the person and the officers. But there's that risk. But our best bet is to talk to each other. It's to bring the information forward. If you're somebody listening to this, that if you see something, let us know. Let somebody you trust know. And for us, it's to work together in collaboration to get those resources.
A follow-up question, too, relates to that, and that is, our school resource officers, do they receive crisis intervention training?
Of course, all of our school resource officers, as with every Boise officer, has received crisis intervention training. It goes on, and we have a couple different levels, and almost every school resource officer now goes through the full long school in addition to the ongoing training. They also get specialized training around youth. Obviously, that's what they're dealing with. And they're there to detect, they're there to protect, and they're there to build that relationship. And when we've got that potentially disaffected young man or young woman, to help them, to watch out for that bullying. I can tell you, when you're talking about something, and I don't want to have a topic like a school shooting, but it's when somebody feels, as Ross led with, alienated from society. That's when you create that precipice for somebody to drop off a cliff. If somebody feels a part of, they feel included, that's the thing that stopped them. I cannot tell you how many stories I've read or watched interviews with somebody that said, I was going to do this, but X person smiled at me. Somebody shook my hand. Somebody stopped to ask me how I was when I was on the way out the door to do something extremely violent. It's not just us and the service providers in the community that can make a difference. It's every single person listening to this by just connecting with those people around you, making that positive human contact. It makes a difference.
Thank you. Are there changes in Idaho's criminal laws that need to be taken to ensure that people with mental health needs are not just routed into prisons and jails and given access to the health care that they need?
Well, I guess I would start by saying Idaho doesn't have a not guilty by reason of insanity law. It doesn't exist in Idaho. We do have laws that a person that has been charged with a crime that is deemed not competent to stand trial is then committed actually to the Department of Health and Welfare for restoration of competency to go through their trial. I think that prisons are often, and in many states across the country, the number one behavioral health provider in the state, right? They're huge behavioral health providers. 40% of people that are in prisons have serious mental illness. That's a lot. But I guess I would also say that the vast majority of people that are charged with a felony don't go to prison. They go right back out to the community on probation. You know, we have resources for that. So do I think that the laws need to be changed? I think laws, we always need to, as the chief has pointed out over and over again, talk to our partners across the country and across the state to figure out ways that we can always get a little better. But I think in Idaho, we do have a challenge in terms of that not guilty by reason of insanity law. Sometimes it leaves people, I'm not passing judgment on it, whether or not we have it. I'm just saying it's a challenge for a system to not have that law. It's a challenge because those folks end up in prison or they end up in our institutions. So,
I just add, I would agree. I don't see any problems in the legislative laws that are in place. The people that are ending up in prison, it's because they did something violent, and there is a price to pay to society for that. I'm not seeing people go to prison that didn't do something that got them there. It's not going there for the obvious of the minor things. And I see that because at every level, whether it's the officers, the prosecutors, the judges, they take into consideration those pieces of mental illness which might have played a point. And I see them taking the appropriate route with that person, whether it's our mental health care court, whether it's getting somebody in service, or it's whether, hey, this is not going to change their behavior. And again, as I said, it's not an excuse. It's not a get out of jail free card. It's looking at what the underlying circumstances were in totality. But I really do see that happening consistently, not just here, but across the state.
Great.
I would add, just in my experience working in the field, just in the last 4 years, the number of phone calls that are received from officers, and I know Penelope receives these on a daily basis, where someone has committed a small misdemeanor sort of crime, and the officers will contact us and say, this is not a criminal issue. This person has mental health challenges. What can we do? Those calls have increased in the last 4 years. Officers are recognizing that this is not something that this person needs to go to jail for. This is something that they need to receive treatment for.
And that brings up a question that came from several people, and it's a question about for those who need counseling or medications and are not insured, what resources are available to help meet those needs?
There's actually a lot of resources to help people's needs, and I think that's a bit of a I don't know that everyone knows that. I think they think, well, if you don't have insurance, if you don't have Medicaid, you can't really get care and services. The Department of Health and Welfare has offices in every single region of the state and a number of field offices in which we have state staff that stand ready and prepared to help people suffering from mental illness. We do focus on people who are sort of at the deeper end in terms of the significance of their mental illness. It's not just a diagnosable mental illness, but it's serious mental illness. And so that's how we have tendency to focus on. But there's a number of really wonderful programs out there that serve people on a sliding fee scale. So I've said all that. Here's the truth. The truth is, in my opinion, the number one thing we can do in the state of Idaho to help people with serious mental illness is to get them connected to a benefit. I don't know what benefit that is. I'm not here to tell you what that benefit should be. But I'll tell you, getting people all across the state access to a benefit, and a usual source of care is the best thing that we can do for people with mental illness in the state of Idaho.
Okay. This, Ross, is again for you, but I think we'll all be interested in the answer. We have a lot of teachers and students here.
Okay.
And how does mental health first aid help with identifying someone who may need mental health support before they reach a crisis state?
It's a great question. Briefly, a lot of us know what first aid is, right? Take that, maybe get a little class in it, walk in the store, and there's first aid kits on the wall. Several years ago, there was a program designed called Mental Health First Aid, and it's a really wonderful program that helps everyone be able to identify somebody, look for the symptoms, make yourself available. And so the way that it helps, I think, is really helping anyone who participates in Mental Health First Aid know what to do. Know what to do when they come into contact, when they observe somebody that's suffering from mental illness, take the steps. They don't have to be a counselor. They don't have to be a police officer or work as a first responder. It's just recognizing what to do and how to refer them and help them get access to care. And sometimes it just starts, as the chief has said several times today, it just starts with asking them.
Great. Okay, we have several questions related to homelessness, and this one is phrased in a very interesting way. Those who reach out for help usually will be able to get help, but how about those who can't reach out? And homeless people often don't have a way to contact others. What's the relationship between what we're doing in improving mental health calls and the homeless population?
So we all understand, as we mentioned, that it's a higher occurrence rate, mental health issues within our homeless population, and a population that has a very tough time getting access to services. And that's a big part of the role that we actually try to do, is to tie people into services. It's our best bet of actually getting them off the street into help. For Boise, we're really lucky. Number one, I have Penelope's and her position and what she's done with it. Number two, I have a highly dedicated police force. But number three, I've got this amazing group of officers on my bike unit. And they are working in the downtown core where most of our homeless providers are, so ends up most of our homeless population. And they get to know these people on a first name. When somebody's new in town, they know it, and they stop and they introduce themselves. This isn't just contacts where somebody's doing something wrong. This is contacts where bike officers are stopping to say, Joe, how you doing? Hey, I know your dog was sick last week. How's Peppy doing? They are on first-name basis, not just with them, the people who are homeless, but they understand their stories. They understand where they come from, why they're there. And a lot of times for us, it's offering the service again and offering the service again and again. Somebody may not take it the first time. They may not take it the 20th time. But the 21st, they might say, I'm ready. I'm ready to go. And I alluded to earlier Penelope going out on the streets. Sometimes that going out on the streets to find the person that needs help, that is a little bit of an Easter egg hunt. And it's because some of those people can be hard to find. But luckily, with our bike unit, we've got that tie-in. They know where, hey, he's usually, you know, on this corner on this afternoon. And maybe we can't find him today, but we'll be able to get him Wednesday. And we'll try to get him tied into services. And our shelter carers, our shelter providers here have been such a great partner for us in getting a pathway to get people into that pipeline of services. There's between our path home and the continuum of care, creating a single coordinated entry program to try to get people into benefits. Those are two programs that are working in Boise right now. And instead of a person having to go to a dozen different places, jump through all kinds of hoop to sign up, they can go to one place, sign one application, and that group will work together to say, who's the best fit? How do we get somebody into resources? What's the timing? So while it's a very difficult population to serve, I honestly believe that we're probably doing one of the best jobs of that in the country. And it's not me. This is because I've got officers and staff that just deeply care about the people that are there to serve.
Just to add one thing. So we have a federal grant. It's a grant we've had for years and get for years. It's called PATH. It's related to homelessness. And actually, through our PATH grant, we hire certified peer specialists through a contractor. We have a contract. That contract hires certified peer specialists. That's a person who themselves are in recovery from a serious mental illness. We call them a peer specialist. We have like two of those in every region across the state whose entire job is to go out and do outreach to the homeless population. I said maybe 35% of people in prison have a serious mental illness. We're talking 60%, 70% and above people that are homeless have a serious mental illness. So,
okay, great. And I would like to, our last question, and I actually think both Ross and the chief maybe have given us their. If you could wave a magic wand, what is the one thing that you would do? And if we just give you a chance to give the succinct thing of what you just said in answer to those two questions and then give Dawn a chance, then that will wrap up our forum today on the intersection of policing and mental health.
Great. I'll start. But I'll take liberty to not have a magic wand. I'm going to take a genie because I get three wishes. That way, instead of just one. So number one is people need access to a benefit. I want people to have access to a benefit. When I say that, I hope you all know what I mean. I mean insurance. People need access to insurance. That insurance needs to have parity. In other words, they need to pay for mental health care appropriately. So those two things. And then the third is we need to change the way we view mental illness in our society. We have to change the way we look at it. We have to change the way we talk about it. And we have to change the way we treat people that are suffering from it.
I knew you were going to do that, Ross. So he stole mine, and it's because this is totally doable. This is not a money issue. This is not a big lift. This is just tear down that veil of stigma that exists mm-hmm. around mental health. Open it up and have a conversation. Treat it like any other medical condition, and we can turn this on its head. We can make a night and day difference instantly for something that costs society not one single dollar. All we have to do is remove that stigma.
Well, they both pose such high, lofty goals. I'm not sure where I can come in with this, but I think my wish, honestly, just to be a little less high and lofty, is all of the good collaboration that we do here in the county. We do it on a face-to-face, anecdotal, this is what I know about this person. I would love to see us have some sort of centralized communication program way that we can all have access to these this information. I have to pass along to our other community paramedics the things that I learned in CITC every 2 weeks. There isn't anywhere that I can that lives. So to be completely selfish about what I would like to see is a way for all of the connected entities that have done such great work together to be able to connect on a regular, ongoing, daily basis.
Great. Join me in thanking our panelists for today.
You have been listening to the City Club of Boise, a public forum discussing important issues of the day in a nonpartisan, civil manner. The next City Club Lunch Forum is on Thursday, the 4th of October, and it's a conversation with candidates for Ada County Commissioner, Kendra Kenyon, Diana Lachiando, Jim Tibbs, and Sharon M. Ullman. Find on-demand audio of this and other forums, learn about becoming a member, and see a schedule of upcoming events at cityclubofboise.org. Connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.